Welcome to the post-UFC 106 edition of the Torch Audio Update. I am Torch editor Jamie Penick, joined today by Torch columnist Matt Pelkey to discuss last night's Ortiz vs. Griffin 2 event from Las Vegas, Nevada. Matt, this card was riddled with injuries, fighters pulling out at the last second. It was really a ravaged card. It was supposed to be headlined originally by Shane Carwin against Brock Lesnar for the heavyweight title. That, obviously, we know came out because of Brock Lesnar's situation at the moment. But then just 2 days before the event, Carl Parisian pulled out of his bout with Dustin Hazlett. So we were down to just 10 fights on the card. And the UFC, once again, aired prelims on Spike TV. And we got to see 9 out of the 10 fights on the card, though we got to see 3 of them twice. So what were your overall thoughts on the card, and how do you think it was how do you think it was pulled off, considering all the injuries and illness that happened to the card?
Well, all things considered, I thought this is a pretty successful show for him. The crowd didn't seem that into it. That probably had something to do with the fights being changed so often and just kind of a bit of a lack of big names and big fights on the card. There was nothing groundbreaking. There weren't any Fight of the Year candidates or anything like that, but everything was at least okay, and some of it very good. And you had some real star-making performances on this card. Ben Saunders gets himself right back into the mix at welterweight and proves that maybe the fight with Mike Swick was just a matter of, stunned by the bright lights maybe a little bit the first time he was in a featured fight, but he really took it to a tough fighter in Marcus Davis. Great win for him. Josh Koscheck, I think, surprised everybody by employing a smart game plan and taking out a really big, tough fighter. And Josh Koscheck himself is a big welterweight, and he was dwarfed by Anthony Johnson out there. That was amazing to see somebody that much bigger than Josh Koscheck, and yet Koscheck used his wrestling and pulled out a win. So I think the story was more the performances by individual fighters than the fights themselves. I don't think we really, announced any new serious contenders at this card, but it was an enjoyable night of fights. And like you said, we got 9 out of 10 fights, so good job by the UFC trying to give people their money's worth, knowing that they put up a lot with a lot of changes going into this card.
Let's move to the Spike broadcast, and our first fight of the night was Kendall Grove against Jake Rochelt. And this one looked like it was going to be a bad night for Kendall early. Rochelt kind of overwhelmed him a bit standing and then got him to the ground, and looked like he was going to use his position in that first round. And then Grove tossed up the triangle and locked it in quickly, and that was the case of Rochelt not having enough experience in defending that hold, because it didn't look like it was on extremely tight and didn't look like something he couldn't have gotten out of. But I think his inexperience kind of had him sitting back on his ass there, and he had to tap out, or he was going out. And Grove picks up a desperately needed win after losing to Ricardo Almeida this summer, and does it in impressive fashion at the end, even though he was being overwhelmed early.
Yeah, that was a nice performance by Kendall Grove. He kept his composure. The fight kind of went how I think most people thought it would, with Rochelt kind of muscling around Kendall Grove. Most of the wrestlers in the 185-pound division are going to be able to do that to Kendall Grove, but it showed Rochelt's inexperience here, controlling the fight for most of the way, and then just gets locked up in a quick submission and says, oh crap, I got caught, and taps out. I don't really know why he tapped out so quickly. He didn't even allow himself to get short of breath from being in that triangle before he tapped out. I would have liked to see him just at least make an attempt to pull out, or use his brute strength to try and pick Kendall Grove up and slam him or something. But he knew he was caught, so he tapped out. It's a nice win for Kendall Grove. I'm not really sure this moves him too far up the ladder. He submitted a guy who's inexperienced, and his weakness is his submission defense. Kendall Grove, Dan Miller, not exactly virtuosos on the ground, but both have been able to catch Rochelt making a rookie mistake. So he's got a ways to go. He certainly has a lot of talent. I'm not sure how far he can go, but it's really too early to tell. Kendall Grove, good job. It seems like he keeps saving his job every time, because he's just the kind of fighter that feels like one more bad performance could be the way out the door for him. But he he put on a nice performance here, and you know, give him another step up, and maybe somebody a little outside the top 10 next time, see what he can do.
Next up, we got our first prelim fight that wasn't scheduled for air, and George Sotiropoulos against Jason Dent. And this one, I think, went exactly how people were expecting it to go, outside of Jason Dent showing a much more impressive defensive game than I think a lot of people thought he had. Sotiropoulos had him in bad spots throughout the first and second round before finally securing that arm bar after getting him in the spider web and the arm crush. That was just a highly impressive finishing sequence by Sotiropoulos. But again, we've seen it from him before in even more impressive fashion from his top game. He's got an excellent, excellent top game. His striking, a bit suspect, but he used this fight to kind of work on it a little bit. He's going to need to take fights to the ground against some of the bigger and better strikers in the lightweight division. But this is Sotiropoulos again, doing nothing but submitting people and picking up another win. And I don't think anyone thought Jason Dent was going to win this fight at all. But I think he impressed a lot of people with how well he was able to defend what Sotiropoulos was throwing at him.
Yeah, this is a really enjoyable fight from a technical perspective for me. Both guys were throwing crisp punches and landing. Neither guy has a whole lot of power, so it was unlikely we were going to see a knockout or anything from this fight, but both guys look good on the feet. Sotiropoulos is fantastic on the ground, and he's a huge 155-pounder. He competed on the Ultimate Fighter at 170. You can tell at the weigh-ins that he has to cut a whole ton of weight to get down to 155. But he's able to do it, and he always looks fresh on fight night. So there's really nothing else to do but throw Sotiropoulos to the wolves. He's in his 30s already. He's not, you know, he's not a young up-and-comer. He's ready to fight who's there to fight him. Jason Dent acquitted himself well here. I still think he's a little small for the lightweight division. He'd probably be better served, you know, pulling a Leonard Garcia instead of being the plucky punching bag in the lightweight division. Go down, move down, and actually be a bigger fighter, and all of a sudden have more tools in your tool belt to fight people with. But Sotiropoulos, let's see what he can do against somebody better, because right now he's very technical on his feet. He's got good boxing. I think he spent time as an amateur boxer in Australia, but he just doesn't really have a whole lot of power behind his strikes. But he can use them to set up his takedowns, and then once he gets on top of you, it's pretty much a wrap. I sent a text to my friend last night saying watching Sotiropoulos on the ground at the end there was like watching an Eddie Bravo instructional video. Just picture-perfect, you know, spider web into the arm crush, and then Dent lets his arm go because he doesn't want to get his arm broken and goes right into the arm bar. It was really good technical stuff. And for my money, that might have been my favorite fight of the night to watch.
Next up was Marcus Davis against Ben Saunders, and this may have been the most impressive, this was the most impressive victory of Ben Saunders' career, and I, in some respects, was more brutal than his victory over Brandon Wolfe. He beat the hell out of Davis with knees the way that Marcus Davis has never been beat before. Davis hasn't been finished before, and Saunders finished him less than 4 minutes into the first round with two knees to the jaw that dropped him, and then landed a couple of unnecessary punches on the ground. But Davis's face was messed up after this fight. He took a ton of punishment, got cut in about five different spots on his face. Saunders brutalized him with those knees, and you know what? That's exactly what his game is, and if he's able to get that tie clinch on you and get those knees up to your face, you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, great performance by Ben Saunders. I'm a big Ben Saunders fan. This was great to see. I like Marcus Davis too, but I think this fight certainly confirmed my belief that Marcus Davis is probably starting the downslide of his career. We've probably seen him at his peak maybe a year or two ago before the Mike Swick fight. He's a very solid, very durable fighter, and Ben Saunders just took it to him. He used his length like he should. You know, he like you said, he has great knees from the clinch. That seems to be his favorite weapon. He's huge for a welterweight. He's absolutely enormous. He's 6'3", and he's not that skinny. I don't know how he gets down to 170, but he does. We had maybe the two biggest welterweights in the UFC on this card with Ben Saunders and Anthony Johnson. But I like that this fight showed that Ben Saunders I think the loss to Mike Swick, not necessarily that it was a fluke, but his performance, I think, was a fluke. Mike Swick is a very good welterweight, a top 10 welterweight. But I think Ben Saunders has the potential to move into that kind of territory with the physical attributes that he has and the fact that he's a psychopath, I'm pretty sure. One of those never going to quit type of guys, so you put him in there with anybody and he's going to give everything he has. And if he fights in the future like he did against Marcus Davis, in another 2 years, we could certainly see Ben Saunders as a contender in the welterweight division.
Next up was the fight that I thought was the most shocking I've seen in a long, long time. Brock Larson against Brian Foster. This is a fight where both you and I have touted Brock Larson as quite possibly the most underrated welterweight fighting in the game. We can't say that anymore after his last two fights. He got upset by Mike Pierce, and then he just got handled by Brian Foster in this fight. I couldn't believe what I was watching as I was watching it. Got 2 points docked in the first round for kick to the face when both Foster's knees were on the ground, and then a DQ when Foster had his hand on the ground for 3 points on the ground there. And that second round was just impressive as hell from Foster. He came out with a fire under his ass and basically just beat Larson down, picked him up, and dropped him, which is something that you don't see very often against the guys from that Minnesota Martial Arts Academy. Those are the wrestlers. Those are the ones doing the slamming. And here Foster picked him up and dropped him and just unleashed shots on the ground. Larson just couldn't take anymore finally at the end, and he was hurting bad. I couldn't be more impressed by Foster after this victory.
Yeah, very impressive victory by Foster, but certainly you're right, the bigger story coming out of this is what happened to Brock Larson. He had only two losses in his career versus, I think, 26 or 27 wins when he made his UFC debut, and his two losses were to John Fitch and Carlos Condit. I mean, two of the best welterweights in the world. Those were his only two losses, and he steamrolled everybody else. I mean, he's a big, physical, imposing force in there, and he got beat down here. He was physically not the stronger fighter. He couldn't impose his will, and for a guy like Brock Larson, when he can't impose his will, he doesn't have a whole lot of other skills to get him by. And I think that's happened in his last two fights now. I think that's just the most surprising thing, is that, you could understand if he gets caught in a submission or something like that, like he did against Carlos Condit when he caught him with an armbar early in that fight. But his last two fights, he's just gotten physically dominated, and that's a scary proposition for Brock Larson, because that's his game. And if he can't do that, then I don't really know what else he can do. He still has a very, gaudy, impressive record. I think he's now 29-4. So certainly he's worthy of getting another fight before he gets the pink slip from the UFC, but this certainly, to me, smells like Brock Larson just kind of on the quick downslide of his career.
Yeah, I would agree. Moving on, Amir Sadala and Phil Baroni open up the pay-per-view portion of the card, and this was a highly enjoyable fight to see Amir Sadala and Baroni in the first round. Otherwise, this was a Phil Baroni fight. Plain and simple, this was Phil Baroni rocking Amir early in this fight. He had Sadala in a lot of trouble in the first round, but Sadala showed a toughness we haven't seen from him yet in taking a beating from a guy that very well could have knocked him out in that first round. But Sadala held on. He clinched smartly to stop the damage, and then, you know what, the rest of the fight after the first 3.5 minutes was all Sadala picking apart Baroni, who had no gas left in the tank, and an impressive victory from Sadala with the decision here, and did what he needed to do in the second and third round to keep Baroni at bay and not even give him a chance to unleash a knockout punch. It was nice to see from Amir.
Yeah, nice Muay Thai display by him in the second and third rounds here. Like you said, the first round was a typical Phil Baroni fight. He comes out swinging, he punches hard. He's really hard to knock out. He has a rock-solid chin. He just doesn't know much else to do other than get punched in the face and punch people in the face. That's kind of his game plan every fight, and if he doesn't catch somebody in the first round, it's usually bad news. This basically looked like a carbon copy of the Joe Riggs Phil Baroni fight from Strikeforce a few months back, the last Strikeforce fight for Phil Baroni. You know, Amir just picked him apart. I was impressed by Amir being able to recover from getting knocked around in that first round. It kind of made me wish he had gotten to take a couple more shots from Donnie Hendricks in his last fight, because he was getting up after he got knocked down. So who knows? He's a tough kid. He could have recovered and maybe pulled out that fight. I don't know. But it was good to see him get a win. He's a likable guy. He's a guy the UFC wants to succeed. He's a guy I want to succeed. He was, you know, an underdog that I was rooting for when he was on The Ultimate Fighter. And he has a lot of skills, and he seems to have found his home in the welterweight division. He looks like he makes that cut pretty easily now. He's kind of a natural welterweight, and he's not a big welterweight, but he's not a small one where he's just necessarily always going to get physically dominated by his opponents. He has a lot of skills. If you put him on his back, he's dangerous off his back, and he's got great strikes. So good win for Amir Sadala here, and probably one more fight before we say bye-bye yet again to Phil Baroni in the UFC.
Moving on to Luis Cain against Antonio Rogério Nogueira in his UFC debut, and what a debut it was. He knocked, he got the TKO victory on Luis Cain and rocked him silly the way that Cain has not been hit before. This is just as impressive as you could come out with it. I mean, a lot of people were maybe suspect of what Nogueira's done with his striking and thought maybe it wasn't as good as advertised, but I would think after this performance that that type of talk would be quelled a bit, because he battered Cain here and took him out in under 2 minutes, and Cain's a tough guy that hits really hard himself, and he just didn't even have a shot after Nogueira rocked him a couple of times and finished him off with after the knockdown punch, and that was it. And impressive victory for Nogueira.
Yeah, very much so. One of the many impressive victories we had on this card. If you want to know the difference between the two Nogueira brothers, it's that Lil Nog doesn't have all the miles on his body that Big Nog does. He hasn't been through, you know, 35 wars where he gets his face pounded in before he pulls him out. He's been in a few of those, certainly, but he has far less fights than his brother. He carries less weight on his frame. He's just generally a sharper fighter, and he's not necessarily... Every time we watch Nogueira fight, we either celebrate the fact that it seems like the old Nogueira is back, or we lament the fact that it seems like he's lost a step and maybe is you know, coming close to winding down his career. That's not the case with Lil Nog. Minotauro looked great here. Very crisp hands. The fight never even hit the ground. It didn't have to. He used his crisp boxing. He put down a fighter that hasn't been stopped, and most people had as a top 10. You know, these were two consensus top 10 light heavyweights, and Nogueira just seemed like he was kind of in a different league than Cain here. He's going to need another fight or two, obviously, to get in the title picture, and that's especially complicated if Machida is still the champ, since they train together and are friends, and they're all managed by Ed Soares. But you know, this is certainly a very good first step in his introduction to the American fans.
Well, you know what, Randy Couture is talking about wanting to get a shot at Lyoto Machida. Screw the fight against Mark Coleman. He just went through a battle with one Nogueira brother. Throw him in with Lil Nog. Let's see what he's got. I think Randy might get destroyed in that fight, but if he wants a title shot and thinks that at 46 he can get there, a guy like Rogério is one that you're going to have to beat, and I think that'd be a fight that could be very easily sold after the war that he had with Rodrigo in August.
Well, and that's a perfect fight to set up for the next contender after the Shogun Machida rematch, because it's fresh. You know, Couture dropped down because he wanted a title shot, where he had a very kind of unimpressive, lackluster win over Brandon Vera. So I don't think that one over Vera, coupled with probably the same win over Mark Coleman, necessarily earns you a title shot. So yeah, match him up with Nogueira, a much more respectable, highly ranked fighter at this point. So that either way, you get a new fresh challenger to the 205-pound title, and they've earned it with back-to-back victories over really good opponents.
Moving on to Paulo Thiago against Jacob Volkman. Volkman making his debut here. And you know what? Despite losing, I think, at all three rounds, I had a 30-27 on my card. Volkman was very impressive in this fight. And he hung in there with Thiago throughout, had some bright spots of his own, but not enough in any of the rounds, I think, to take a round of his own. And I know some people gave him the second round, but really this was Paulo Thiago doing what he needed to do to win another fight and looking pretty good in a victory. We're getting to see more of Thiago's overall game after his shocking victory over Josh Koscheck earlier in the year. You know, the loss to John Fitch, he still held his own there, and here, he did what I think a lot of people thought that he would do, and to just take more of an advantage over the newcomer and have a little bit more than what Volkman was going to have, and that's what happened. It wasn't the most exciting fight, but it was a very solid, very good back and forth between both guys, and a bit of a stalemate at times, but definitely an impressive performance from both guys, even though it wasn't the most exciting thing to watch.
Yeah, I think this was basically, whereas John Fitch is, you know, slightly better at what he does than Paulo Thiago is at what he does, Paulo Thiago is a little better at his game than Jacob Volkman was at his game. There was a grappling meet, and Thiago won the grappling meet. There's really not much more to it. It's another win for Thiago. He's going to need to string together several more wins, and they're going to have to be impressive if he ever wants to get into the title picture. You can say, yeah, he has a win over Koscheck and a win over an undefeated fighter and a loss to, you know, maybe the second best welterweight in the world in a very close decision there. But nobody's clamoring to see Paulo Thiago get a lot of high-profile fights right now, because he's going to kind of drag people down and control them. He needs to show a finishing ability on the ground, because that's where his specialty supposedly lies. He caught Josh Koscheck with a punch, but I think we can all agree he doesn't exactly have fantastic stand-up. He has decent pop in his punches, as he showed against Volkman, too. Put together a couple combos a couple different times in the fight that dropped him. But Thiago needs to be matched up. Like I say usually, when the UFC doesn't have anything invested with a fighter, throw him to the wolves, see what he's got. If he pulls off the win, then all of a sudden people go, hey, this guy's pretty good, and then you have a guy you can market. But if not, then he goes back to the drawing board, and you go, okay, we don't have to worry about a boring fighter mucking up our title picture. So throw him to the wolves, see what he's got, and hopefully he can give you an impressive performance and a finish next time out.
Moving on, Josh Koscheck taking on Anthony Johnson, and this fight was a little strange with a couple of illegal blows stopping the bout for a bit. And the first replay on Johnson's knee to Koscheck when he was down, I mean, all the replays were showing that Koscheck didn't get hit in his left eye, and yet that's what he was grabbing at. I had one of our readers point this out to me and rewatched it and saw it. What happened was Johnson, when he reached in to grab his head, caught him in the left eye with his right thumb, but they didn't show show that initial setup on the replay at all. So that's what had Koscheck, that's what hit him in the eye first, and then Johnson hit him with the illegal knee. But outside of that, Koscheck showed a much crisper and a much more technical striking game than Anthony Johnson here. Got in with a lot more shots, avoided a lot of what Johnson was trying to throw at him, and outside of poking Johnson in the eye as well, it was really just the much better fighter on the feet. And then once he got it to the ground, late in the second round, it was him using his wrestling in a way that we haven't seen him do it in the last couple of years, and just trying to find his position, and finally pulling off a rear naked choke in a spot where that's a difficult spot to do, because you're rolled up against the cage there. His back was up against the cage. He couldn't completely stretch Johnson out and really lock that one on tight. He only had one hook in, but he got that in with the forearm across the throat and wrenched it to the point where Johnson had no choice but to tap, with 14 seconds left in the round. Very, very, very big win for Josh Koscheck, and then he called out Dan Hardy after the fight, which was kind of funny because he made mention that Dan Hardy hasn't fought anyone when Dan Hardy just beat his teammate in Mike Swick. So that one was rather interesting to hear him say. But I would argue that Koscheck probably does deserve a title shot more than Dan Hardy. But at the same time, he's also fought against GSP before. And Hardy will probably get that shot. And they're not going to delay the welterweight title shot even more to have Koscheck face off against Dan Hardy in February.
Yeah, they already said Hardy gets the title shot. They don't want to keep going back on their words when they tell people they're going to get something like they did to both Dan Henderson and Nate Marquardt and then bypass them both with Vitor Belfort. So you don't really want another situation like that. Let Dan Hardy get his title shot. That's fine. Koscheck, it wasn't that long ago that he got knocked out by Paulo Thiago either. So he still needs to string together a couple more wins. Like you said, he's already fought and lost to George St. Pierre. The other way that he can spin it certainly is that wasn't a title shot. So Josh Koscheck hasn't gotten a title shot yet, and we've seen before where guys will lose to, have lost to the champ previously, but before they were the champ. So you can earn your way back up to getting another crack at that person. But Koscheck is 5-2 since the loss to George St. Pierre, so it's not like he's exactly been setting the world on fire. He has had a couple of setbacks in that span, the knockout loss to Thiago and also a decision loss to Thiago Alves. So he certainly needs at least one more win over a pretty tough top guy before he gets the title shot. I just don't know who that's going to be. He's already fought Thiago Alves. I don't necessarily think they'll put together that rematch. There's really not a reason to. He's not going to fight Mike Swick or John Fitch. Those are his teammates. So who else really is there at the top of the division? Maybe a Paul Daly or something like that. But those are really the only options for Josh Koscheck right now, other than getting a title shot. But he wants to fight all the time, so give him fights. As far as Anthony Johnson, I think this kind of proved that he's really not quite ready for prime time. As great as his power is in his strikes, he still looks a little stiff to me from time to time, like not totally comfortable throwing it. He's obviously a freakish athlete and a huge guy. He'll be a huge middleweight when he finally can't make the cut down to welterweight anymore. But right now, he just needs to keep learning. He needs to learn submission defense, because once that fight hit the ground, Josh Koscheck kind of controlled him, did anything he wanted to, and choked him out pretty quickly when he got the choke on. So Anthony Johnson is certainly still a very bright prospect, but it's back to the drawing board for him, and he really has a lot of stuff he needs to work on before he can think about title shots.
Moving on to our main event of the evening, Forrest Griffin against Tito Ortiz in a rematch of their bout from UFC 59 in 2006. Forrest comes out to the perfect entrance song for him, comes out to Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba. You know, I get knocked down and I get up again. That's the attitude he needed to have here. This is a fight that I think he felt he needed. He ended his honeymoon early to come and take this fight, to train for this fight. And you know what? Outside of three takedowns and a few elbows in the second round from Tito Ortiz, Forrest Griffin picked him apart and kicked his ass in this fight. Leg kicks, combinations, he beat him up pretty good, especially in that third round. He absolutely beat him up in the third round. And Forrest Griffin picked up a much-deserving split decision victory. I can see the arguments that Tito could have taken the first and second round, but I disagree with them, because the takedowns themselves should not negate everything else that Forrest Griffin did in those rounds. And the fact that Ortiz opened up a cut with an elbow, I mean, he landed maybe three elbows and Forrest still got to his feet with plenty of time left in the second round. I disagree with takedowns having so much weight on judges' scorecards to take rounds like that when he clearly got picked apart on the feet other than that. And I thought Forrest Griffin won this one outright, and the judges gave it to him. And big win for Forrest Griffin to rebound and A rematch between the two is likely to come to get a rubber match where hopefully, you know, they're both 100% healthy because Tito Ortiz once again went to the injury card and excuses card after losing yet another fight because, God forbid, he just gets beat by the better man on a night. He's got to have some excuse for it. And both fighters kind of lectured the fans after about injuries happening in training. And the thing is, like Wade wrote about last night, the fact is they were harping all week about how Tito Ortiz was 100% healthy and was as healthy as he's ever been. And so for him to sit and lecture the fans about having a cracked skull and injured neck and blah, 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 we've heard it before, Tito. Take your lumps, accept your loss, and move on. It's something he can't do.
Yeah, I don't really understand that either. The thing is, like Forrest came on the mic as Tito was being interviewed and said, hey, when you train to fight guys, you get hurt. That's true, but that's true for everybody. So everybody comes in with nagging injuries or more than nagging injuries every fight. That's an old cliche in fighting. Nobody comes into a fight 100%. Well, that applies for everybody. That applied for Forrest Griffin last night. I don't understand why Tito seems to think, he says, well, hey, everybody gets injured, but my injuries are worse, and that's what made me lose. Their injuries weren't bad enough to make them lose. You know, just take your loss. Both guys come in banged up, so nobody has an excuse. I had this fight scored 29-28 for Forrest. The first and the second were very close. I gave Forrest the first and Tito the second because the second, I think Tito spent a little more time in control on top to steal that round by a slim margin, and Forrest spent a little more time on the feet doing damage in the first round to steal that round. And then the third round was clearly all Forrest Griffin. I saw you had it scored 10-8. It was close to a 10-8 because of just the fact that Forrest was controlling the fight for the entire 5 minutes and landing at will. The only thing that I thought kept it from being a 10-8 was the fact that he didn't actually, like, knock him down or really have him close to being finished. He battered him for 5 minutes, but it wasn't, he didn't do that much damage to really get close to stopping the fight. But I did think Forrest won the fight. He certainly spent the majority of the time in control of the fight, did far more damage. I was really happy for him. He needed this far more than Tito Ortiz needed this. Tito's kind of bulletproof, and all he needs is a couple big wins, and he can talk himself into a title shot somehow. Forrest Griffin was coming off of a devastating loss, and people really didn't know where his psyche was. We didn't really know if the Forrest Griffin we had seen before was gone, but he was back. He outworked Tito Ortiz. He took every shot that Tito Ortiz dished out and did it with a smile. And he just kept coming for three rounds. It was a vintage, to quote Michael Cole, a vintage Forrest Griffin performance. And, you know, beating Tito Ortiz doesn't necessarily mean you're right back in the title picture, but he's back on the right track. He doesn't have two losses in a row, and he certainly doesn't have three losses in a row. Now he has one win in a row, and he'll try to put together a win streak in his next fight out. I don't really know who that's going to be against. They are teasing, you know, doing the third fight again, and I've even heard somebody suggest, well, what if you base the next season of The Ultimate Fighter around them being coaches? I'm not sure I'm really interested in that, but, you know, good win for Forrest Griffin, and I'm really happy to see that he got back on track and seems to be, you know, happy about what he does in life still.
Here's my argument for the 10-8 in the third round, and actually the Fight Metric report supports this. Forrest Griffin landed 41 strikes to 5 strikes in that third round. 32 of which were high percentage strikes to the head, or to the head and the legs. He landed 28 strikes to the head to 4 from Tito in that round. Tito did barely anything, and I think we need more 10-8 rounds when a fighter isn't doing anything and the other fighter is putting as much offense as he did, as Griffin did in that third round. I understand, yeah, he didn't knock him down. He didn't land any really, really damaging blows. But the fact is, he picked him apart and landed shot after shot after shot after shot through that five-round period, and I thought it was well worth a 10-8 there. I don't think there are enough 10-8 rounds. I'm in that camp that doesn't think there are enough 10-8 rounds scored. especially in a situation like this where Ortiz just literally did nothing in this round.
Yeah, you know what? I'm actually with you. That's my solution for the problems we have in the scoring system, whereas now it seems like every round is a 10-9 round one way or another, and it takes a pretty monumental beatdown. It's hard for a guy to survive a 10-8 round in today's scoring system. My solution would be if a round is really close and the judges sit there and go, man, I don't know who won that round, don't flip a coin and say, well, I guess it was this person because they landed three more leg kicks. Call it a 10-10 round because you couldn't decide a winner. If you watch the round and the round is close, but you say, yeah, but you know, this person did more to win that round, that's a 10-9 round. If a round is pretty well controlled by a fighter and they do a lot more damage than the other one, just like that third round, that should be a 10-8 round. And what we consider, what is judged now to be a 10-8 round, which is just a complete and utter beatdown of a fighter for 5 minutes, that should be a 10-7 round. That's where you get a little more variance in the scoring, and that way a fighter that's doing a significant amount more damage in a round won't lose, you know, a razor close decision because somebody eked out the other two rounds. They could either get a draw based on, you know, blowing out a round, or even a win if they have a completely dominant round and could get a 10-7.
Yeah, agreed. Well, and just so you have this too, because I've got it in front of me, going on, they've got it 29-27 for Forrest in the 10-point must system based on their computation on grappling and striking and their effectiveness score. They've got Griffin in the first round, Ortiz in the second, and then in the third, their effectiveness score is 175-13 for Forrest Griffin. So it's one of those blowout rounds where, yeah, it wasn't damage, but it was nonstop points, and he was hurting him with those shots. I mean, it wasn't damaging to the point of knockout, but he was hurting him pretty badly with those shots in that round, and had him staggered a couple of times. And that was one of the best rounds of Forrest Griffin's career, and just picked Tito apart, and Tito just had no answer for it.
Well, and I would also say, using that argument, you could certainly say that the second and third rounds of the Baroni-Sadala fight could have been scored 10-8 rounds, too, because those were basically just Amir picking Baroni apart for 5 minutes, and Baroni would eventually, you know, swing wildly and maybe catch Amir with a punch, you know, once every minute and a half in the fight, but didn't really faze him. And other than that, he was against the cage just taking punishment on every part of his body. So those were certainly, I think, 10-8 rounds scoring that way, too.
Yeah, that's very possible. Very possible. Well, Matt, any final thoughts on the card, and what are you looking forward to here in December with the Ultimate Fighter finale and UFC 107 coming up? What are you most looking forward to finish out the 2009 fight season?
Well, certainly, BJ Penn, Diego Sanchez is the first true main event we've had since Shogun Machida, so it'll be nice to have a title fight and two guys that are really going to go out and put on a show. And then at the finale, obviously, whoever, I think we're setting up to have a pretty good, you know, as lackluster as the fights have been on the Ultimate Fighter, there's going to end up being four pretty solid fighters in the semifinals. And then whoever's in the finals should be a pretty good matchup, too. I'm still not sold on the fact that there won't be six or seven guys from this season fighting regularly in the UFC after the season's over. So I look forward to whoever matches up in the finals, and I'm really looking forward to the Matt Hamill, John Jones fight on that card too.
Yeah, agreed. I think Matt Hamill, John Jones, is an excellent fight night style main event. The two of them should put on a show there. If Jones can get past Hamill, that will just continue to solidify his legitimacy after only, what, a year and a half, 2 years in the game. Definitely one of the brightest up-and-comers we've seen in a long time, and just a freak athlete. And then Diego Sanchez, BJ Penn, I get more excited for that fight by the day, because I just think it's going to be one of the better. I mean, I said this about the Kenny Florian-BJ Penn fight, and it just did not come to fruition, that it was going to be one of the best lightweight title bouts that we had seen. Diego Sanchez might pull that out of BJ Penn, because he's going to be aggressive, like BJ hasn't seen, and he's going to be able to he's going to be able to land some shots on BJ Penn in that fight. His boxing is comparable, probably not as good as BJ's, but it's up there, and I'm highly excited for that fight.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a fight that I think we expect to go at least three or four rounds, if not the distance, but one of those fights that even if it only lasts 4 minutes into the first round, you expect it to be a classic, because you can't imagine either fighter is going to hold back. Diego brings everything he has every time he fights, and BJ Penn is on a mission to prove that he is the best lightweight in the world, and then he can, you know, go back to trying to fight guys that are 200 pounds after a few more title defenses.
All right, Matt. Well, thank you for joining me once again, and thanks, everyone, for listening. For Matt Pelkey, this is Jamie Pennock signing off.